ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The world has gone crazy. Books are being edited by misguided woke people. Seriously, it's actually happening. Hi, I'm Amanda Vanstone. This is Counterpoint, a weekly dip into different ideas from around the world. And today, we take a look at cold-blooded animals, turtles, snakes, insects, who will all need more energy if temperatures rise. And they'll have to compete for that. In medieval times, there was a lot going on every day. Life was tough. And looking after babies took extra care and extra time. Imagine how much reinforced concrete there is in the world, in homes, offices, apartments, shopping centres, bridges. Hi, yi, yi. And now imagine that it's slowly rotting. Now there's a real problem. Time to panic? Maybe. But first, why are classic books by Agatha Christie, Enid Blyton and Roald Dahl being in effect rewritten? Heavens above, read the other day that sensitivity readers, I think they're called, have gone through and made hundreds of changes to Roald Dahl books. That is, the new prints of them will be, in essence, different books because they'll use different words. And the people reading them, the kids reading them, won't necessarily imagine in their mind the same images they would with the original words. What in heaven's name is going on in the world? Now, fortunately, Oliver Trowdy, who's a graduate student in philosophy at the University of Notre Dame, has given some thought to this issue, and he joins us now from Indiana. Oliver Trowdy, what is going on? Roald Dahl, these harmless books, and they've paid people to go and rewrite them. You know, I think the people who we should be attacking are Roald Dahl's estate for allowing it, but let's put that aside. Let's go to the question of why it's happening.
Yeah, thanks for asking. So what I think is going on is that a certain theory of language and how language works has sort of become popular among people in industries like journalism and publishing, and certainly in academia. So this is a theory on which words can kind of take on these kind of magical proportions and kind of take over our brains, you know, make us think things that we don't want to think. So, you know, in addition to the Roald Dahl books, recently a language guide came out of the IT department at Stanford saying, for example, that the phrase circle the wagons might evoke images of savages, might be offensive to Native Americans or something like that.
Let me stop you there. You know, it might be a bit of cultural cringe we have had in the past in Australia. You know, we have to say to ourselves, all intelligence was not cast by any almighty you happen to believe in the Northern Hemisphere. But if you say to people, oh, this person works at Stanford, people would think, oh, can't be an idiot. You know, if you got a job at Stanford, you must have something going for you. But then you tell me, you know, they've got a guide called Elimination of Harmful Language Initiative. Now, why do they think you can get rid of that language? I mean, it used to be you can't say those things, they offend people. Now they want to get rid of that language, not use those words ever. How does a university meant to be a cradle of, you know, interaction of ideas and thought and disagreement, how do they get to that?
Yeah, good question. So I certainly think universities have been changing, and you look at kind of demographic political party statistics over the years, you know, you'll see fewer and fewer, you know, in the United States, the right-wing party is the Republicans. So here you see fewer and fewer Republicans. You see more and more far-left progressives, socialists, Marxists. And I think part of what's happening is just that there becomes a kind of monoculture, right, in which everybody agrees to begin with. And so any disagreement is a real surprise. People kind of gain points by upping the stakes on just how bad the other people are, if that makes sense.
I mean, look, I don't agree that calling a discussion paper a white paper racializes something. But I can see how some people might, in a very simplistic way, do that. And as you mentioned in your article, using the qualifying adverb subconsciously helps them get away with it. But, you know, you use another example. Using the word Seminole constitutes male-dominated language. I mean, seriously. Mm-hmm. And even reinforce has to become reinscribe. I mean, what is happening here? The next question, you may or may not know the answer, but it's pretty clear to me that if it's happening for Roald Dahl, it's happening for a lot of other things as well, a lot of other areas. And if Stanford University is doing it, other universities are doing it. Do you have other examples?
Not offhand, but I certainly know that sensitivity readers, I mean, the sensitivity readers may be here to stay. There might not be anything to do about that. And as obvious as it is, when it happens to a book that's already been published, the real danger is which books are being changed before they're being published and which books are not being published at all, right? So if you think about what has to happen to Roald Dahl to make it acceptable to this kind of viewpoint, then think of all of the books that might be unacceptable that might be authored today.
Mm.
And what's happening to them.
Yeah. How many great books are not being published because authors who used to be the tellers of truth, I mean, I know that a lot of stories aren't true, but you know what I mean? They brought concepts to us, even if the words weren't literally true. If they're being censored by their editors that they can't use this sort of language, it's going to change the way novels come out. Now, what did Steven Pinker have to say about all this?
Yeah, so Steven Pinker has an old article from almost 30 years ago now called The Game of the Name. So Steven Pinker's idea is called the euphemism treadmill. And basically, he was thinking about the phenomenon in which a word, for example, a minority group that's often discriminated against, the kind of common word will begin to take on the connotation of a slur, and then a neutral word will be introduced as a kind of euphemism, which then itself kind of takes on a slur quality itself. So for example, you know, no sooner was it introduced than that the phrase mentally handicapped began to be used as an insult by some people, right? So what Pinker believes is this process, you know, if you want to change the connotations of words, you have to change how people feel about actual things, right? If you want a word to have a positive connotation, then you have to have people think positively about what it's pointing to. You can't just introduce a new word for the same thing, because then that word is going to gain the same connotation as the old one, because it's the thing.
Yep.
You know, it's what it's describing that is what people actually have feelings about, not just the language.
Ah, yes. Okay. You're on Counterpoint. I'm Amanda Vanstone, and I'm lucky enough to be talking to Oliver Traldy. He's a graduate student in philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. We're talking about, well, you know, why do people think, if they're going to get anywhere, changing the language in Roald Dahl books? Why are they doing it? But will they achieve anything? Here's the answer. No. Oliver, do you have in your mind any thoughts as to why, when Steven Pinker said this sort of thing, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, I think you say, and I'm thinking of Monty Python's Life of Brian, they had a skit which some people today regard as offensive, where one of the guys was sitting around and said he wanted to be a woman. It's my right as a man. And it was hilarious at the time, and some think it's hilarious now, some think it's offensive. But if people were pointing this out to us 20 or 30 years ago, why haven't we cottoned on?
It's a good question. You know, I think this temptation to feel this way about language has always been, because obviously rhetoric does matter to an extent. Obviously, people are convinced by certain kinds of rhetoric, and politics is affected by the way that politicians talk. But I think this view is always going to be popular when people just cannot imagine that other people disagree with them for any good reason, right? When they can't imagine there's any good reason that anybody could possibly disagree with me, they're going to say there must have been some trick, you know, a trick of language or, you know, a trick of whatever, right?
Yeah.
And I think what you have today is you have a lot of industries and sectors and parts of the culture in which people are not used to disagreement about these sorts of issues, about political issues, but more so even issues of, you know, what they call identity and affinity. When you're just not used to the disagreement about these things, you have to come up with some magical explanation of how somebody could possibly think this thing that just seems ludicrous to you.
Mm. You finished the piece by pointing out that there's always been progressive bureaucrats, an illiberal desire to stamp out disagreement. And then you talk about the Great Awakening, a story about swathes of intelligentsia. Tell us about what you want us to understand about the Great Awakening.
Yeah, so the Great Awakening in American politics, at least, it refers to a phenomenon over the past 10 or 12 years in which many, many institutions have become more and more radically left-wing, especially on issues of identity, and have been more and more punishing of disagreement. And issues of identity have become more and more prominent in politics and in entertainment. You know, just a very, very multifaceted kind of event or period in history or whatever. So it refers to, you know, woke ideas, you know, social justice oriented or progressive ideas about identity and politics, and about censorship and free speech, about firing people for saying certain things. Those ideas have become more and more popular in this era of wokeness. And the Great Awakening refers to the kind of quick march to dominance of these sorts of ideas.
Mm-hmm. And what do you mean when you say these people place their faith in sorcery?
You know, I mean something very concrete. In a fantasy book, right? Maybe a Roald Dahl book even, somebody casts a spell, right? They say a word and the world changes, right? And so, you know, that's what I believe this theory of language involves. I believe it involves people thinking that you speak and it alters the world. It's the opposite of what Steven Pinker thought, right? Pinker thinks the world is what makes people feel how they do, and they express that in language. But these people think by expressing language differently, the world is going to appear different to people and may even end up being different, right? So that's the sense in which it's magic, the idea that you're changing the world actually just by opening your mouth and uttering some syllables.
It is somewhat incredible, isn't it, really? Oliver Traldy, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterpoint. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
Speaking of Roald Dahl, he had tortoises at his house. They're cold-blooded animals. So let's look at what will happen to them under climate change. We worry a lot about how we'll cope with climate change, but, you know, what about the animals? Mammals, birds, and the cold-blooded ones, snakes, lizards, that sort of thing. Now, some of them, the cold-blooded animals, obviously, might need to adjust to a slightly higher temperature. That's true. But is that just in their own system, or do they have to cope with a different environment because other animals respond differently and therefore maybe they're in a different environment completely? We need to find out more about this. And to do so, we're going to talk to Leslie Alton. She's a research fellow at Monash University and she joins us now. Leslie, what's your favourite cold-blooded animal?
My favourite cold-blooded animal is insects. Yeah, I love working with insects. They're very amenable to conducting experiments in the lab. They're small, generally, so they don't take up much space in the lab. They have very short lifespans, so they're easy to do experiments.
Leslie, I have to stop you there. It doesn't sound like you love them. You just find them useful.
Oh, well, they are.
They're good to be in the lab. They're small. They don't last long. They're very convenient. So let's get back to one that you look at and you think, gee, that's cute. I like that. Ooh, and it might be an insect.
My first experience with insects was actually with a PhD student in our group who was studying cockroaches. Now, I myself have never studied cockroaches before, but most people respond as you have done, and that's with disgust. But actually, when I was working with this PhD student, she opened my eyes to the amazing behaviours that cockroaches have. So, you know, from that moment on, I was just super excited about these little animals that display really complex behaviours.
Well, we might have to talk to you another day about cockroaches. We had a guest some time ago whose favourite pet was a little cockroach.
There you go.
Good on him. Now, what's the story with a warming climate and the cold-blooded animals? Some of them can adjust, but what happens when they get a bit warmer?
So body temperature is a really important determinant. it'll determine how much energy an animal will use. So when our body temperatures increase, the biochemical reactions that underlie our metabolic rates, our rate of energy use, they speed up and they go faster. So when the body temperature of an animal increases, its rate of energy use will accelerate exponentially, which means
that
they're
going, needs more food.
They need more food to survive in warmer environments.
Right. So they've got to do more running around.
Yep.
Just like chasing a mate. It can take more energy.
Yes.
Now, how did you work all this out? What experiment did you do in the lab to figure that out?
So it's a well-studied response in animals that when you expose them to an increase in temperature, that their metabolic rate will accelerate exponentially. So that's quite well-established. And the other thing that's quite well-established is that ectotherms can physiologically acclimate to warmer temperatures, which basically means they can remodel their physiology to respond to changes in their environment to make it so that they can cope with those changes in their environment.
You're on Counterpoint. I'm Amanda Vanstone. I'm talking with Leslie Alton. She's a research fellow at Monash University. And she's been doing research into how climate change threatens cold-blooded animals. You did something in the lab. What did you do?
Yep. So the difference with my research compared to previous studies is that we not only exposed insects to changes in temperature, we did it in a more realistic setting. So we actually reared these insects with another species. That's not often done. We just look at animals' responses to changes in temperature. But in nature, animals have to face lots of different challenges, and one of them being that they have to interact with other species.
Others, right. You, in a sense, in the lab, you made it more realistic.
Yeah, we tried to, yeah.
Okay, and what happened?
In our case, we used the fruit fly as a model insect species to study responses to changes in temperature. And when we reared the larvae of these fruit flies at warmer temperatures with another species, we found that the adult flies that emerged from these environmental conditions, they had higher activity levels, which meant that they expended more energy. So under warm conditions, when they're exposed to another species, they actually have higher rates of energy use.
Right. So it's not only the rising temperature might make them need more energy, it's that because they're not on their own and their interactions with other species will make them need to use more energy.
Yeah, exactly.
So what does that mean?
So basically,
where does that leave us in how we look after these ectotherms?
Yeah, it just goes to show that at this stage, you know, we know that based on their physiology that we can make these predictions that their energy use will increase. But actually, these predictions might be underestimating how much energy cold-blooded animals will need in the future. So what our research suggests is that maybe we're underestimating the costs, the energetic costs of climate warming for cold-blooded organisms. So basically, it shows that we need to keep improving our research to try and better represent the natural conditions and the challenges that animals face in the natural world.
So, I mean, I know you like insects and I find them fascinating, particularly the fabulous photography you can get these days of the close-ups of insects. And you see the intricate design involved. It's just fantastic. And, okay, worms, but there's also fish, crustaceans, amphibians, and reptiles, and including in that, I assume, all sorts of turtles and tortoises.
That's right.
So we're not just talking about looking after the insects. We're talking about looking after some of the cute things as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, in terms of biomass and the number of species, most organisms on our planet are cold-blooded. So, yes, some scientists have estimated that there are 200 million insects for every single human alive today. So there are a lot of them.
Well, invertebrates are about 95% of the animal kingdom.
Yeah.
So, that's a lot when you think about it that way. We tend to think of animals, you know, elephants and stuff, but really the invertebrates are a lot of it. We have to look at the things we don't like looking at because they're an important part of, you know, the ecosystem that we depend on.
Right.
And we have to be more careful about how we respond in terms of climate change, looking at these animals that generally get, by the general community, ignored and taken for granted. You know, everyone's worried about the Goldian finch. Not too many people are worried about, you know, spider or whatever.
Yeah, without insects, we wouldn't do very well. You know, they're very important for many reasons. Obviously, a lot of people will think of them as pests that destroy crops, like locusts. Some of the people will think of them as disease vectors, like mosquitoes, that will have negative health consequences for humans, and, you know, termites will damage our homes. But most insects are actually beneficial, so they pollinate crops and they're actually used to control other insect species. So ladybirds eat aphids, so that's a really important role that insects have. You know, and they're an important...
Do you know you can buy ladybirds for your garden?
Yeah, right.
You can buy them. They get them through the post, they come in a tube and you let them out and away it goes, apparently.
Yeah, we actually do purchase a lot of the insects we use in our lab. They get delivered to us through the mail.
Is that right? There's an industry in Australia.
Yeah,
and insect production.
Yeah, and it's used for, you know, people who look after reptiles, like, you know, lizards and snakes. You know, there's a whole industry there that relies on insects as food for their own animals at home.
It's a bit yucky, isn't it? But, you know, as you say, we can't live without them. People get it with the bees. They like bees and they say, oh, save the bees. You know, we won't be able to eat if we don't have the bees. But if the soil isn't turned over and other pests aren't kept in check, we won't get the food either. So insects, they're the saviour of the day. Leslie Alton, thanks for joining us today on Counterpoint.
Thank you very much.
Does it drive you crazy when you see something on the net and there's a tempting little button with find out more, click here to enter, or whatever? And then you discover you're getting nothing from these people unless you give them your name and email address, etc. No. Just redirect me to a web page if you want me to click on something. And when you don't redirect me to a web page, when you insist that the person who's clicked on your button gives you their name and email address, well, we all know instantly that we're dealing with a tricky operation. So don't go any further. Just don't click anymore. Click out of there. Go somewhere else. Perhaps medieval children were lucky because they didn't have computers. What did they have? Medieval times might not be of interest to many people, but that's because they think of them in a particular way. When you speak to someone who knows a lot about it, you can find some fascinating things that were going on then that we were just never taught when we were kids at school. Catherine Harvey is an historian, writer and reviewer, and she specialises in medieval history, so our luck. She's an honorary research fellow at the University of London, and she teaches for both Birkbeck and the Open University. She's the author of The Fires of Lust, Sex in the Middle Ages, 2021, and she lives in London, from where she joins us now. Catherine Harvey, welcome back to Counterpoint. Can I ask you, you wouldn't want to be a baby in the Middle Ages, would you?
Well, no, you wouldn't, particularly because you had a very high chance of dying. The best estimate is that about 30% of babies didn't make it to their first birthday, and about another 20% didn't make it to adulthood. So to be a baby in the Middle Ages is to be, very, very vulnerable.
Yeah. In your piece for Aeon magazine, you say 7 of King Edward's 16 children died before their 7th birthday. And Catherine of Siena's mother gave birth to 23 kids, but only 8 lived to adulthood. Now, this is a terrible thing for children, but it's equally not great for families, you know. I mean, these days when someone loses a child, we think it's far worse grief for them than if a parent dies, because you don't expect to bury a child. That's what we hear people say. But in those days, you did expect to bury children, didn't you?
Yeah, an awful lot of parents would have buried at least one of their children. And that's meant that some historians have sort of argued that, well, medieval babies must have been largely ignored because parents and society more generally wouldn't have wanted to invest either time or resources or emotions in these very fragile creatures. Mm. But actually, the more you look at medieval babies and how people felt about them, you realise that people really did love their children and were very upset when they died. The Italian poet Petrarch wrote a particularly moving account of just how devastated he was when his baby grandson died. we could still identify with that now, I think. So they may have been very vulnerable, but it didn't mean that people didn't desperately try to look after them.
No. And they understood that children were, in a sense, delicate and needed particular treatment. How did they go about that?
Yeah, so, I mean, in a lot of ways, in the same ways as they went looking after themselves, they very much realised that sort of your environment, things like your diet and sort of keeping you warm and looking after you generally is really important. And so there's an awful lot written about medieval baby care and how you should look after babies.
Yeah, so they put a lot of attention onto the air and environment that was around, the diet of kids, whether they slept, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, a lot of the same things that still concern us. So there's an awful lot of talk, for example, about breastfeeding. And very much they saw that as being the ideal, that the mother should breastfeed her child. And for all sorts of reasons, the ideal medieval mother is the Virgin Mary, who obviously was famous for breastfeeding Christ. But also they thought that that was really the healthiest food that you could give a baby, and that it would help to sort of create an emotional bond between mother and child. And also that a woman would pass on her characteristics through her milk. So if you are a kind woman, by breastfeeding your children, you'll make sure they're kind too. Obviously, there's a flip side to that. It could go wrong, couldn't it? But that's the idea.
Well, I couldn't help but laugh. I mean, it's not funny, but it just seems outrageous when you mentioned the saintly woman, the 12th century Ida, Countess of Boulogne, who nursed all of her three sons, and she was, you know, emulating Mary's maternal devotion. But she came back from Mass one day to find out that another woman had fed her screaming son for her. She made the child vomit because she didn't want the child to have someone else's milk in them. I mean, that is taking "I must breastfeed my child" extraordinarily seriously.
Very, very seriously. I mean, probably most people wouldn't have gone that far. And in fact, a lot of people do use wet nurses. And sometimes that's because, particularly in the case of rich women, they want to hurry up and have as many children as possible, and they realise that breastfeeding can be a contraceptive. But obviously there are all sorts of practical reasons. Women whose milk doesn't come in, women who need to work. And of course, there was also quite a high level of maternal mortality. And so that would be the obvious solution to that. They do have sort of horns that they use, a bit like bottles, that they can feed babies with animal milk. But that's seen as being a bad option. Obviously it was a bad option we can see in terms of hygiene. But they were also worried that if you gave a baby animal's milk, it would sort of take on the qualities of that animal. So you're going to end up with a stupid bovine baby if you give it cow's milk. So you don't want to do that.
Yeah. Okay. Now, breastfeeding, unlike other mammals, because of where the breasts are placed in humans, does allow them to be fondled while they're eating. And there is a view that that makes a difference to a child's personality. Do you agree?
They thought that, yes. And they were very concerned that, that would be a good thing and it would help the mother to bond with her child. And that mothers who wouldn't breastfeed were very much criticised by male doctors and male clerics for sort of prioritising their looks and their social lives and everything other than their baby's wellbeing.
Mm. You're on Counterpoint. I'm Amanda Vanstone. I'm talking with Catherine Harvey. She's an historian, writer and reviewer at the University of London. And we're talking about medieval babies. Gee, they had some ideas about how to look after them. I noticed that some of the medical writers at the time thought the babies were fed too much and too often, as in on demand. But when you hear mothers today, I think if the baby cries and it's hungry, they feed it. Is that a bad thing? I don't know anything about this. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, again, it was something that was definitely a debate about in the Middle Ages Some doctors say, well, actually, you should only be feeding the baby 2 or 3 times a day. That's quite enough. But they complain that women do feed on demand. So I think probably it was something that a lot of others did even then.
Mm. And, of course, they thought, understandably, that what a mother eats and drinks is, in a sense, passed through or affects the mother's milk. And I noticed that the mother should avoid onions. Okay, duck, yep. Freshwater fish, yes, fruit, and strong wine. Now, I'm not sure about avoiding all fruit. I mean, that's a bit rough. It's probably good for a mother to have fruit. Mm-hmm. But when they say strong wine, I mean, I'm not sure of the system in the United Kingdom, but I serve on a board called Drinkwise that tries to encourage people to drink sensibly, since saying to young people, just don't drink at all, doesn't work, you know, in their 20s, drink sensibly. Mm-hmm. And especially for mothers in Australia, we have labels on the wine bottles, you know, not good for you to drink at all while you're pregnant. But they were saying in the Middle Ages you can't drink strong wine. Well, what does that mean? A big glass of sherry or something, but you could have a little nib of white wine. Today's health advice is no, you can't.
think they do tend to have a more positive attitude to wine than we do, because they see it as something that sort of warms the body and is good for you in that sense. So, in small quantities, it could be good, to the extent that there's actually a debate over whether you should actually give the baby wine. And there are some people who think that actually, it's okay to give a baby a little bit of wine. That there's even one 15th century German physician who discusses what you should do if the baby is basically addicted to wine and you can't wean it off. And the answer is, well, just give it a little bit of well-diluted white wine. That's okay. Not everybody thinks that's okay. Definitely there are people who go, well, no, you shouldn't give small children wine. It gives them pain, it gives them fevers, and they'll get addicted to it. But it was definitely an option.
Here's another one that I thought was extraordinary. They had the view that while mothers were feeding, not literally at the time, a nursing mother, for the duration of the months that she was nursing the baby, was advised not to have sex because that would reduce the quality and quantity of milk. Now, how on earth did they get to that idea?
I think it's got a lot to do with ideas about the interchangeability of bodily fluids. So that they think that milk is sort of a converted form of menstrual blood. And so it's all linked in terms of it's very easy to corrupt one body fluid by playing with another one. And so, that they actually took this to the point that they thought the worst thing you could do was to get pregnant when you were breastfeeding, because that would completely mess up the quality of your milk and might even kill the baby. And so one of the things they're very concerned about when they pick wet nurses is they think that you should choose a woman, ideally, actually, who her baby has died, so that she's not feeding two at the same time. They're very much against that. But also you get cases where if the wet nurse gets pregnant again, they take the baby and they give it to a new wet nurse because her milk is seen as being spoiled and dangerous to your child. So they take it really seriously.
Yeah, I haven't heard anyone these days make that point, because some people do get pregnant easily within a year of having a child. Others choose to wait longer, but I haven't heard that point. But look, the overall issue here is that we think of the Middle Ages as being, kids were brought up, made to work on the farm, really used, if you like. But what you're telling us is there was quite a body of thinking and effort that went into making sure that kids were properly looked after.
Yeah, a lot of evidence that they're worrying about their care, but also that they're doing things like they're playing with them. There's a lot of stuff about making sure that you play rattles with your babies, bounce them around, gently tickle them. There are baby walkers. There's guidance on how to teach a baby to walk, which is very much like we would today, helping it to cruise along the furniture and all that sort of thing. Yeah. So, there is this real sense that they do invest in them as little people, just like we do.
Well, we shouldn't look back on the past and think it was all that dark and gloomy. In fact, one way to look at this, of course, is that the knowledge we have today doesn't come from the past, but it's built on knowledge that was there in the past. So, looking down on the body of knowledge is a bit stupid, because that's from which we have climbed up. That's how I look at it. Do you look at it that way?
Yeah, and I think we've got a lot more in common with our distant ancestors than we think, in terms of, the things that we worry about and the things that we do. There's a lot more continuities there than people often assume.
Catherine Harvey, thanks for joining us on Counterpoint again and reminding us that we can learn a lot from the Middle Ages.
Thank you.
Medieval people surely had concrete. In the early Roman times, it's all there and it's still standing. But our concrete, not so. Heavens above, there's a lot we have to worry about, isn't there? Oh, we're using too much oil, bad thing. Coal, bad thing. Gas, cows, they burp and, you know what else they do. And concrete. Hadn't thought of that one, had you? Well, here's a real counterpoint. Concrete could be a part of what's killing us. Let's find out some more. And to do that, we're going to talk to Joe Zadeh. He's a writer based in Newcastle in the UK and has a fabulous story to tell us. Well, fabulous in that it's new, not fabulous in what we hear. Now, Joe, what made you think? Where did you first come across? When did the penny drop? I'm going to do an article on the horrors of cement, because it's not something that would have occurred to me.
No, it actually occurred to me on holiday, which is probably even more unlikely.
What?
While I was on a beach holiday in the west of France. It was a little town called Soulac.
Yeah.
And during World War II, it was where Nazi Germany decided to start building the Atlantic Wall, which was this gigantic concrete wall that they wanted to build around all of Europe to stop the Brits from coming back in. And all that's left of it now
was going to work, yeah.
Yeah, and they never finished it. It was a ridiculous idea. It was 4,000 kilometers long. They ended up sort of giving up on it. And all that's left now are these gigantic concrete bunkers across beaches all over the coasts of Europe. And in Sulak, there's a high prominence of them. And you see them now, they're just these gigantic concrete monoliths just lying on their side. Some are still in the cliffs, some have fallen down onto the beach. And it just got me thinking, like, what happens to concrete? Like, where does concrete go? Like, this looks like it's going to be here for a long time. Like, what about all the other concrete we've destroyed? Where did that go? And when I started looking around concrete as a topic, I realized that it's a really fascinating substance. And
it sure is. Look, I'm so grateful you took a holiday in France. We're on the beach looking at these ridiculous concrete bunkers. Now, let's get to the basis of it for starters. Let's give everybody an idea. Why is concrete a bad thing?
So it's a good thing and a bad thing. Like, that was the story I wanted to explore here, was that it's this sort of a real conundrum with concrete, in that it's one of the most useful substances we've come up with, but the amount we use it is quite unbelievable when you start looking at the facts. Like, it's the second most consumed substance on the planet, behind only
after
water. Yes, that's the only other thing.
I couldn't believe that. I thought, he can't be serious. But you are. Second most consumed substance after water.
Yeah. I think around 33 billion tons a year are used. And the figures get so big, it's completely unfathomable, really.
Yeah.
Okay. But with that, now, I mean, I don't know.
We use all that, but what does that mean?
So, yeah, with all that consumption comes, obviously, the cost of creating that concrete. Most cement plants, and cement is like a primary ingredient in concrete, along with sand, gravel, and water. Cement plants need to heat kilns to, like, you know, the sort of temperatures you'd see inside a volcano. To do that, they burn a lot of fossil fuels mostly. And to gather the sand and gravel and water that is needed, like, there's a lot of sand mining of rivers, beaches. I think around 2% of the world's water is used for the manufacture of concrete. And the fact that cement is a process itself to create it releases CO2 in the process. Mm-hmm. So all this, when you add it all together, you end up with this kind of carbon monster. CO2 emissions are like 8% of all CO2 emissions, which sounds like opaque, but if you compare it to like aviation, air travel, that's 2 to 3%. And, you know, a lot of us have thought deeply about how much we need to fly, changes to our life because of that. Then you realize that something like concrete is just gigantic in comparison.
Honestly, Joe, I think this is a fabulous story. I'm not laughing because it's funny that we have all this concrete around and we use all this energy in producing it. It's a bit like, you know, some hydrogen plants. People say, oh, hydrogen's going to be clean. But they don't look behind that to how much power you have to use to produce the hydrogen and deduct that power off the power that you can then produce with hydrogen and look at the cost. But in any event, we're onto concrete. Okay, there's a huge cost in producing it. And we don't think twice about it. We walk along concrete pathways. We use concrete in buildings. But there's another problem, isn't there? And that is it doesn't last forever.
No, it doesn't. I always think of concrete as a very modern thing, but it's actually quite an ancient thing. Like, the Romans built with concrete, the Colosseum and the Pantheon are built with concrete. And that concrete's lasted like thousands of years. So there's a real association with concrete as this sort of, you know, man-made rock that lasts forever. But modern concrete is very different to what the Romans used. We reinforce it with steel rebar to make it stronger than concrete is by itself. And because of that steel reinforcement, it really limits the lifespan of the concrete. Essentially, when the CO2 in the air, of which is now growing a lot more than it was during the Roman times, but when that kind of permeates the pores of concrete and gets to the steel bars inside, it causes them to rust. When they rust, they expand, and when they expand, it causes cracks in the concrete. And they call this concrete cancer, is what it's termed in the industry. Because of this, reinforced concrete, which is basically almost all the concrete you see around you today, only lasts around 100 years. And when you consider that we really started using reinforced concrete at a really huge scale about 100 years ago, you get this quite dystopian vision that a lot of the concrete around us is starting to fail. And you see this in infrastructure reports out of America, but also like a few quite high profile disasters. Like, there was a bridge in Italy that collapsed in 2018. There was a tower block in America that collapsed in 2021. And in Britain, where I am, a lot of our hospitals are now like falling apart. And a lot of that is because the concrete ceilings are starting to cave in. And yeah.
Well, why did we change to using the reinforced concrete? I mean, as you say, it's been around forever. It's been used. The Colosseum's still there. What occasioned the change?
It was the type of concrete the Romans used. Like, they actually used volcanic ash from Vesuvius. And it was basically, we couldn't make that kind of concrete now. I'm not fully sure why, but I got it from concrete experts that told me that you couldn't mass produce the type of concrete they made now. So reinforcing concrete sort of squares a corner that we need to get around, in that it adds this extra tensile strength to the concrete, makes it harder to pull apart.
Sure, but there's the rotting aspect that's the problem. This is Counterpoint, and have we got something for you to think about? Concrete is a bad thing in its current form. We're talking to Joe Zadeh about this, and has he opened up our minds? We're now facing not a doomsday, but a serious problem with concrete all around the world that's going to, or is already, falling apart. So we've got a massive regeneration task.
Yeah, one of the people I interviewed for this story described it to me as, like, while the global south is kind of embarking on a century of construction and building all the infrastructure and the housing they need, the global north is now kind of in a stage of maintenance, demolition, and in some cases, like, ruination.
So we can focus on the issue of, you know, concrete that's falling apart, but people are looking at other ways to build, including using more timber, which is a bit of a counterpoint to what people generally think. They don't think of timber as being as strong and therefore not as lasting. What's the story there?
Yeah, there is a lot of solutions to this story. And one thing I wanted to show was that loads of people working on how to solve this. You know, there's people working on green concretes. There's people working on capturing carbon at their cement plants and sequestering it. And then there's people who are focused on trying to use other materials like timber, steel, clay. And I guess with the whole concrete discussion, even I found this when I was coming to it. I was like, oh, well, what's the solution? What is the one big solution to the one big problem of concrete? But that sort of thinking is kind of what created this problem in the first place. Like, we rely on one material way too much. And if we start using timber at the same rate that we use concrete as a replacement, you'll see deforestation on a scale you can't even imagine. Like, you think palm oil's bad. Wait until we start building everything out of timber instead of concrete. There's going to be hundreds of smaller solutions to this problem, and that isn't as sexy of a sell. Like, a lot of people are thinking, right, I'm going to start using concrete. What should I use instead? And the answer to that is sort of whatever makes sense in your local environment and whatever will reduce the over-reliance on this one material.
But look, Joe, I have to say, if that kind of thinking could permeate public services around the world and parliaments around the world, we'd be better off, because people are often looking for, as you say, well, what will I use? Bang, that's it. That's a silver bullet. And the shocking news for everyone is there isn't one. There's usually, for any policy issue, a whole range of solutions. And when we get people focusing on just one, and they say, I'm right and you're wrong, our eyes are shifted away from the range of opportunities that are there to deal with the issues that we've got. But look, can we just mention briefly the tomb out there in the Marshall Islands that was created to store a whole lot of radioactive waste after the US military tests, which were done, I think, not to devise better weapons, but to work out how we were going to cope if there was nuclear war. But that's made of concrete, that tomb. Mm-hmm. How's that going?
Yeah, it's not going well. It's a huge concrete dome that covers basically all of the radioactive material and soil that was gathered following explosive tests in the Initowak Atoll. And it was all put under this tomb, and then the tomb was created and put over the top. And it's reinforced concrete, everything we've just been talking about now. So the lifespan, you know, is around 100 years. It's already starting to degrade, and radioactive material is seeping out the side. And you know, some of this radioactive material contains certain forms of plutonium that have a half-life of, I don't know, 24,000 years. So to even think that concrete would have been a good solution for this sort of is indicative of, like,
stupid.
How... It is kind of stupid, but then what else would they have made it of? Like,
yeah, sure. And haven't people discovered that there are ways to use concrete by the shape of the concrete that you use that will be equally strong but use less concrete, as in cathedrals? I'm thinking of the example of the flooring that can be created that's much, much lighter, uses much, much less concrete, but is as strong.
Yeah. And this came from an architect I interviewed called Philippe Bloch in Zurich. And he came from a history of studying ancient architecture, so the Gothic cathedrals and Islamic architecture. And he wanted to apply some of this sort of geometric masonry approach to concrete. And he did lots of like fantastic, beautiful looking arches. But I think one of his colleagues challenged him, like, how can you actually create something that's really going to change everyone's lives with this approach? And he decided to start working on floors, which is probably one of the most boring topics you could possibly imagine.
Sure.
But he's managed to make these floor panels, which I got to see when I went and visited him in Zurich, that essentially take the principles of vaulting that you would see in cathedrals and applies it to the distribution of pressure in a floor panel. You know, we're getting in quite the weeds with the technicalities here, but because of it, you don't need the steel reinforcement. You're kind of making the concrete do the work of stone to do the work. And as a result, you can use a lot less concrete and no reinforcement, which means these floor panels can be put in tower blocks, which he's working on at the moment. And not only can they go in without reinforcement, that also means that the concrete floor panels can then be sort of taken apart wholesale when that building reaches its end of life and potentially reused elsewhere. And without the steel inside, they're also way longer lasting than the modern concrete we're using today. So I guess the essence of that is that these eras of rampant modernization and globalization, which saw us use so much concrete, you know, achieved amazing things. But with it, there was a lot of diversity of ideas that got erased. Things like what Philippe Bloch was exploring, and him and many others are sort of kind of bringing up the idea that we need to revisit them.
Joe Zadeh, this is a great story, and we're just so grateful that you did it and spared the time to share it with us.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Funny, isn't it? You know, you love nature, but we hate rats. Why? This program is called Counterpoint. For good reason, that's what we bring you. Different viewpoints, counterintuitive views, from smart and interesting people all around the world. Well, today we've got a really good one. We're going to mount the defence of the rat, because the rat has been unfairly maligned for centuries. You know, I mean, they're less pestilent and more lovable than we think. And if you don't believe me, well, you've got to listen to James McKinnon. He's the author of The Day the World Stops Shopping, but more importantly, the author of an article in Hakai magazine in defence of the rat. James McKinnon, thanks for joining us today. And look, I have to ask, have you got a pet rat?
I do not have a pet rat right now, but I have in the past owned a couple of rats, really only for a very brief time.
What's the story about the plague? Everyone says, oh, rats, they're terrible. They spread the plague. What's your view?
Right. Well, I think, as you say, we've all long held this belief that the bubonic plague, the Black Death of the 1300s, was spread by rats, and that it happened through the mechanism of rats being covered with fleas because they're dirty, pestilent animals. The plague would start to spread through the rat population, kill them off, and then their fleas would leap onto humans and bite us and spread the bubonic plague. The problem with that theory that started to emerge sometime around the early 1970s is that people started to realize that there wasn't a lot of evidence, or in some cases, no evidence whatsoever, that there were large populations of black rats, the ones that are known for spreading the bubonic plague, in Europe north of the Mediterranean. So if the rats weren't there, then perhaps they weren't guilty of spreading the Black Death. And of course, the Black Death is the kind of origin story for a lot of our loathing about rats that has continued on to today.
And now this is pretty much accepted knowledge, is it, that they weren't responsible?
It is. Yeah, it's widely held. I mean, I wouldn't say that it's uncontested. There's certainly usual scientific process still at work here, but there are now multiple threads of scientific pursuit, from genetics to history to archaeology, that are all indicating the same thing, which is that there most likely weren't large populations of rats in Europe at that time, and that the way that the disease was spreading is now referred to as the human ectoparasite theory. And what that means is that it wasn't rats' fleas jumping off the rats and biting us that was causing the bubonic plague to spread. It was our own unsanitary habits in that era. and our own tendency as societies to push our poor and marginalized into unclean housing, squalid housing, and that it was our own parasites, human fleas and human lice, that were spreading the disease.
Well, I think that's a good thing. Now, we know a bit more about rats. Apparently, they make really good pets. Now, that's not a meritorious reason for not detesting an animal just because they're a good pet, but it does colour in what has been a pretty bleak picture that's been painted of them. Now, your article suggests that you can play hide and seek with a rat.
That's exactly right. And I mean, this was an absolute surprise to me as well. But researchers in Germany, they set out, it's not totally clear to me why, but they set out to try to train rats to play hide and seek. And it turned out the rats could learn both of those roles very efficiently. But maybe more importantly, they really enjoyed the game. They were really engaged with it. When you read the descriptions or watch the videos that are available of the rats playing hide and seek with the human experimenters, they're much like little children. So for example, a rat that's hiding, once it's found by the human who's looking for it, it'll often run away and rehide so that it can extend the game. And you know, they mention in the study that the rats would even do these little joy jumps. They used a German word for it, but it translates as joy jumps when it was time to play the game. And they would also carry out this ultrasonic chirping that has been associated with what scientists call positive affective states, but what we would call laughter.
You're on Counterpoint. I'm Amanda Vanstone. I'm talking to James McKinnon. He's in Vancouver in Canada, and he's making the case, a good one actually, that rats can be really good pets. And there's other things that have been discovered. The Vancouver Rat Project apparently set up because it was considered one of Canada's biggest rat cities, discovered that rats don't sort of swarm around a city, that they stay in quite a small area, even on one side of the street, for example. Their physical activity counts against them spreading bugs as well, because they stay in their own little home area.
That's right. And Vancouver is my home city, so this really was interesting to me as well. That old image we have, mostly out of Hollywood movies, of rats just pouring through cities, even the movie Ratatouille from a few years ago, it's a pretty rat-friendly movie, I would say. It presents rats in quite a positive light, but even it sort of shows these colonies of rats pouring out into the city. And it turns out that's just really not what rats do. Most rats in cities are homebodies. They don't like to stray too far from their nests. Most of them don't travel further than about the length of a city block in a day. So, yeah, this idea that there are swarms of pestilent rats is really just not supported at this point by the research that's been done.
James McKinnon, when we did this program, I never imagined I'd be interviewing someone on the pleasures of having a rat as a pet. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
And that's it for this week. As ever, thanks for joining me, and I hope you can join me next week for more interesting stories from, well, everywhere. Until then, it's Amanda Vanstone saying arrivederci.
Been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.